listening to Cooper Talk.
Welcome to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper, and remember, I'm only as hip as my guest. And I tell you, people, once again, I just broke the 1,000 barrier of episodes, so I'm bringing back guests, haven't been on for a while. And this gentleman today, I actually waited on him at Gordon Biersch in Burbank many years ago. And then back in May 19th of 2014, he came in the studio in Burbank when I was down there on Olive Avenue, and he did the show. And then during the pandemic, when he was in Toronto in June 21st of 2020, I interviewed him. Now he's back for a third time, just like Rich Rebin was yesterday, and Phil Henry will be soon. My three timers. It's Reed Diamond. How you doing, Reed?
Oh, Steve, man, it's so good to be here. I was telling people, because we go back so far in the day that we were actually in a studio. In your studio, right? So it's like now everyone has a podcast from their closet, but we were in the studio together. We've been in this for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I think about it's almost 10 years, and time flies. So cool. I've noticed.
Oh, yeah.
And we both moved a lot. I moved back east 6 years, almost 7 years. I guess 7 years coming up. And you think about it, as we get older, time really flies. I mean, for you, you went through a whole pandemic, then you're acting, but you've been acting your whole life pretty much. So it must just be weird how when you look back at your career and you go, oh my God, I was on this show in the early 90s, and this must blow your mind.
Well, yeah, because time, right? Time is such an interesting thing. Time is relative, as the great Albert Einstein might have said or maybe didn't say. But I mean, it is, because I still think when someone talks about 2000 or 2004, I go, oh, that was just, that was just a few years ago. And I go, oh, no, that was 20 years ago. My wife and I just celebrated 22 years of being together. And you're going, oh, my gosh, time does fly. And then when you have a kid, right, what they say, the years fly by, but the days are long, right? So there's just, time is really interesting. So, yeah, and when you've been doing it for a long time, I mean, now thank God for IMDb, because I go on a job and I just assume I've worked with some of the people on the show, but I may not remember because it's been 40 years. So I always have to, I do a full crew check before I go on to set, so I don't have to put my foot in my mouth and introduce myself to someone who I did whatever, Judging Amy with, 23 years ago.
Well, it's interesting, and I saw you post this on Facebook, that you had worked with Giancarlo Esposito on Homicide, and then you were
on
Breaking Bad. What is that like when you see someone? I mean, I'm sure you don't keep in touch, because actors, it happens. We lose touch. But what is, first of all, when did you first work with him?
Giancarlo and I first worked together when we came back to do the movie for Homicide. So the series had ended, and then they did a 2-hour movie that Simon wrote, I think, and then John Zagonzak, our DP and one of our directors, directed. And so I'd come, because I'd left the Homicide season 6, and then Giancarlo came on the next year for the final season of the show, and I came back and did 2 episodes, these Kellerman PI episodes, but I'd never met him then, I don't believe, but then he and I had scenes together in the movie. But it was hilarious, because I step on the set of Better Call Saul, and we have that beautiful scene from the final season of Better Call Saul, just one of the most beautifully written scenes I've ever had the great, good fortune to be a part of. And I think at first, he was just sort of in his mode, and he didn't really, I don't even know if he recognized me right away. And we rehearsed the scene, and then the next thing, I'm back in my trailer, and I hear this loud knock on the door, and there's John Carl. I was like, Reed, oh my God! And then he comes in to the room, and we schmooze for an hour. I mean, the beauty of what we do is, my wife says it's so great, when she came out of retirement a few years ago, and her career's back better than ever, but she missed acting. But what she most missed was the people. That you get to meet in this business. We're really fortunate. And just the fact that I get to meet you and all the amazing people you've connected me with. But there's something about people who get into, for lack of a better word, show business. They're faster and funnier. And also, because of the nature of what we do, you have to create intimacy immediately, right? So your relationships, a day on set is like a month somewhere else, because you've had to go through so much together. You're showing up, you don't know each other. Say you have to have an intimate relationship in the scene. You have to establish that right away, but also you're nervous and you're vulnerable. And so friendships get very strong very quickly. And like with my best friends, I grew up in New York City, and I went to school for a little while in North Carolina, and I have friends who live all over the country. So my best friends, I don't see them every year. All right. Sometimes I don't see them for 5 years, 6 years more to pop. But when we see each other, we pick up right where we left off. And I find that to be really true with all the amazing people I've met in my career, who I consider to be good friends, but we might not see each other for a decade. And then when we see each other, we picked up right where we left off. And those are the things that you remember. It's interesting. I was talking to somebody the other day. Someone's writing an article about Homicide because we're coming up on, I guess the 30-year anniversary of that show. And it's interesting to go back and watch episodes because I very rarely remember the scenes that I shot. And so it's neat. So I can kind of almost watch it like a fan. There's sort of a third-person remove to it. But the things that you usually remember that I take from this life, you know, I've been doing this professionally since I was 16, are the funny things that happen between people, the joke that you played, or the thing someone said, or the dinner you had. Those are the things that really stick. The relationships are actually the lasting part of this business, the things that I can remember. It's harder to remember, oh, I did that scene, and oh, right, that's what happened. That stuff sort of, you know, evaporates into vapor.
Now, for the Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
Did you have to audition? Was that an offer? And did they know that you used to own a vineyard? You owned a vineyard when I first met you. Did they know that?
I didn't. I lived on a vineyard. I lived next to, and a bunch of my friends are winemakers. So here's what happened, right? I guess Sharon Bialy, who's one of the greatest casting directors of all time, she's, I'd auditioned for something for her. We're on the road. So it's during the pandemic. So what is that? This is the second year that I'm on the road working during it. So it's probably 21. Yes, 21. And she'd wanted me to get this part on Walking Dead that she cast as well, but it just hadn't happened. And so she called my agent. She goes, there's this incredible scene in Better Call Saul, but we don't make offers. She goes, in the history of Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, she goes, we've made 2 offers. Everyone has to audition. And I have no problem with auditioning. Because especially if it's a good scene, it just keeps your chops up. It's kind of like going to the gym for me. So I don't really, but I was in the process. What had happened is the first year of pandemic, 2020, before we had the shot, I had gone off to do a job. So I went to do, I did the first job back. I did Leverage in New Orleans. And then I went out and did Bosch in LA. And I stayed up in my wine country place. I had my COVID bubble because back in the day you had to stay in your little bubble. And I stayed with my friends in San Ynez. So I didn't see my family. Because they were up in Canada, and there was a 2-week quarantine at that point to cross the border. I didn't see them for 6 months. So in 2020, I left my family, and I had to go to work. We thought, oh my gosh, you know, we thought the world had ended, and we were definitely going to take every opportunity that came along. And they were great jobs, but I was separated from my family for all of 2020. So in 2021, I got a job. The first job I got was a series out in Portland. So I said, nope, we're all jumping in the car. And luckily, my daughter had started homeschooling at that point. So we all just jumped in the car and we drove to Portland. And then I got a job in L.A. and we all drove to L.A. And then my wife had a job up in Toronto. And so she flew back to Toronto. And my kid and I were driving across country when they called me for this Better Call Saul thing. So my daughter and I were in a hotel room in Springfield, Missouri. And I said, hey, and she's, because usually I do all my auditions now because everything's a self-tape. I do it with my wife, but my daughter's equally as good, but even tougher. She expects me to just get it done and get it done right. And we did the scene. It was the scene pretty much as it is on the show. And we just found a corner of the room and there was a wine bottle from room service. And she and I did the scene. And I think we did it in maybe 2 takes. And then I gave a little preamble before you do this thing called a slate where you sort of supposed to say your name and your height and where you're based and all that stuff. And sometimes now, because I do enjoy self-taping, I think from a acting point of view, but the only thing that I miss is that human interaction. Sometimes they don't know who you are, especially if you're playing a character that's very different from yourself. So I spoke to them for a second. I said, hey, you know, I just want to let you know that some of my best friends are sommeliers. I've lived for the last decade in wine country. I know a little bit about wine. And that was it. And a couple of days later, we made our way to North Carolina. Suddenly we're staying in some cabin up in Asheville. And I get the call to go back to Albuquerque, where I'd been just a week before with my kid in the car as we were making our way east. And went there and had just an incredible experience. It was intense, though. The director has talked about it. But one of the fun things about acting is you get older with acting is you, I guess wisdom is the best word, but you learn a lot. And you keep trying, and at a certain point, it's been great now that my wife's gone back to acting because we get to talk about it. But I go, if there's one thing that I've learned since 1985 doing this professionally, if I can give a young actor one piece of advice or one thing that I have to remind myself of all the time, whatever you think it's going to be like on the day, it isn't. It isn't. So if you're doing a tropical scene where you're a love scene and it's going to be 40 degrees below zero, if you think this is the most important emotional scene you have to shoot in the show, they're going to like, we've got a half hour to get this because we're losing the light. Whatever you think it's going to be, it's just not. And it's really, and once I sort of codified that, it's stood me in good stead. And this was that case. So I show up at 5 o'clock at night. 5 p.m. and we're there at a little restaurant where we're going to shoot the scene, and we do the first rehearsal and it goes great. The director's lovely, Giancarlo's great, and it's a 6-page scene though with pretty much me talking the whole time. So we start shooting masters. Now I'd looked at the call sheet, right, which tells you when what scene order, when they're going to be there, and I had a flight to catch the next morning at, I think, like 9 a.m. or something. But I go, oh, they've got an exterior, a nighttime exterior. They're going to have to, that they had scheduled after my scene, so they're going to finish our scene and they're going to go shoot that nighttime exterior. So I thought I'll be in the bar at 2 o'clock in the morning. Like, we're going to be done with this. I'll be in my hotel room. So I violated my one codified mantra and rule. So whatever I thought it was going to be like, it wasn't. So we start shooting the master. It's going great. And then we just keep shooting masters. Masters are wide shots. Now, of course, that show is so beautifully shot. Most of those masters are used. That sort of gives you the feeling of the scene. But I got to tell you, so we suddenly get to like 2 o'clock in the morning and we haven't done any coverage. And we've done the scene a billion times, and people are falling asleep all around us. And then they go, hey, Reed, if it's okay. And that's probably like even four now. We're at four. And they go, we shot Giancarlo's coverage. And then they go, hey, Reed, we got to go get that out exterior night scene before the sun comes up. Do you mind? I'm like, I don't mind, but I had literally done the scene. I lost track of how many times. I go to my room and everyone's falling asleep. The background players are all asleep on the floor of the restaurant. And I go to my room and I just dance I put on some new wave pop and I'm just dancing for 2 hours. Cause I go, if I sit down, I will fall asleep. And I haven't shot my close up. I haven't really shot my side of the scene yet. It hasn't happened, for lack of a better word. So I showed up there at 5 PM at night. We started shooting the scene. I didn't get to my close up till about 7 AM in the morning the next day. And it's a funny thing because you've done it so many times. At one point, I lost my voice because I was just speaking so much. And I always joke that I don't know why I went to Juilliard, because I barely use it. But every once in a while, I use it. So at 3 o'clock in the morning when I'd lost my voice, I did a little vocal technique that I remember they taught me back in the day. And that saved my voice. And then you did your coverage. I did the scene as if it was the first time at 7 o'clock in the morning till 8 o'clock in the morning. Almost missed my flight. But it was magical, right? Because it was one of those scenes that you could just dive into 100% every time, because it was so beautifully written and had such an amazing scene partner. But it was an interesting experience, but they always are. And that part of it I'll never forget. Maybe that will be one of those scenes that I truly never forget shooting.
Well, on a scene like that,
yeah,
6 pages,
mm-hmm.
You know, I can't even remember like the grocery list sometimes.
Right.
And as we get older, we start losing. Yeah. It's just, you know, you think, how do you prepare for something like that? Because it's 6 pages. And first of all, the good part about it is, you know, the show has been on for a while. So the crew's all happy. There's not a bunch of pricks who think it's going to get canceled.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Giancarlo, you know, he's talented. So, you know, you're not going on with some hack who's going to be like, oh, yeah. And you're like, what? What are you saying? How do you prepare for that? Like, how do you... Do you, when you memorize the script, are you at first, do you go right away with the inflection you're going to do, or do you just get it all stored in your head first?
Yeah, so my approach to acting is I want to live truthfully under imaginary circumstances, and what happens between the two of us is much more important than anything that I could have come up with on my own. So preparation for me is... Yeah, got to learn the lines, but I learn them as best I can without. I try never to say them out loud, so they're that I don't put a line reading on them. If I have to, I'll just say them out very monotone. And then my preparation is, who is this guy? But when I get there, I just want to play pretend with the other person, and every time's the first time. So I never plan a moment. I never plan how I'm going to say something. And I'm looking to live truthfully each take. I really look at it oftentimes like preparation is you taking the chairlift up to the top of the mountain, and then each take is just a different run. And you'll try things on runs, and sometimes you hit some ice and you lose a ski, but like I don't plan. And I don't like to work with actors who plan. I like to work with actors who play. In fact, you know, it's interesting that we're called actors because we also used to be called players, right? Shakespeare's players, and that used to be the term. And I kind of prefer that term more than actor, because actor means you got to do something, right? But player means you just play. And that's what we're doing. We're doing a kid's game played at an adult level. So I had a sense, I knew who this guy was. I had a sense of how his inner, how he would occur, but then it comes together when I'm just saying the words and listening to Giancarlo and looking at Giancarlo and just playing. And my goal is for every take to be different, but not just by the nature of that you're doing it as if it was the first time each time. And if you're playing with good players, because my arithmetic for this is whatever I come up with in my room is boring. Like it's done, it's dead, but it's dead on arrival by the time you get there. But if you're working with another actor, it's 1 + 1 = infinity, because I do something, then you do, it's a game of catch, right? So then you spin the ball and you throw it back to me, and that's the joy of doing it. That's what gets me excited, is the playing. And I love accidents. I love for things to go wobbly and find your way back, because anything sort of knocks you out of a preconceived notion or a preconceived way of doing something that's the magic. The magic is the mistake, right? And now on a show like Better Call Saul, like you don't change a word, right? You don't change, those words are the words. But now also, but that's all, like, I wouldn't change a word of Chekhov. I wouldn't change a word of Shakespeare, right? Those words don't need to be changed. But also what I often do on many other shows is I like to improvise because I don't want it to get stale. In fact, I don't like to rehearse if we don't have to. I rather, if we need to block it for the camera, but I don't want to really do the scene over and over again, because I don't want it to be dead because the beauty of film is that it's captured. Right. So and then the editor can get in there and put the pieces together. So why lose the opportunity of your first inspired moment of the two of you having this experience together? It's not repeatable. In fact, I just heard a funny story from Jean de Sagonzac talking about working with Harvey Keitel and working with William Hurt. And William Hurt likes to rehearse and rehearse and rehearse. Or did. I mean, he's passed away. But he likes to rehearse and rehearse and rehearse for 2 hours before they shoot the scene. Now, I'd go fucking mental. And Keitel refuses to say the lines unless the camera's rolling, which I love. And he has an assistant, though, so he'll walk through. They'll do the blocking, but she'll say the words out loud. Now, those are obviously two extremes. But obviously, you know, I'm a team player, and we're making TV, and we got to get the day done. So I'm happy to run through it, but I rarely will ever... I will rarely ever approach it like a performance until we're shooting, because you're going to capture something. If something happens, something you didn't expect to happen, that's on film it's on some digital memory card forever. And that's the magic of what we do. Theater's different. So theater, you get to rehearse for 6 weeks so that when you get on stage, you can forget it. But the beauty of film is it can be literally the first time. And I just love that, because that's what got me into it.
But how do you acclimate to someone who doesn't want to play? Like, I've had guests.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah. I let my guests talk, because I always say this. You know what? People listen to my show because of my guests. And I learned how to be a good interviewer. And I want to hear. Like, I had Tom Arnold one. And I said, just tell me 3 good stories. And the guy told... and I was just enthralled. So, but right. but I get guests who I want to interact with. And sometimes
sure.
they're very one answer, you know, and you're waiting because
of course
you're waiting. Yeah. So when you're on set, because you like to play, how do you do a scene when you're with someone who's just rigid, like just isn't giving it? Like someone, it'd be like saying, you know, we use the term by the book, like I am here,
right.
here's the script. How as an actor, how do you acclimate to that? Do you try to change it? Do you just run with it? Or what do you do?
Well, you know, there's a whole, I keep copious notes now. I do these after action reports. I have a whole tome of my acting where I do a, you know, breakdowns for my characters, sort of, you know, their backgrounds and my preparation work. But also if I've had a rough day at set, because I'm constantly learning. And the one thing that I know in doing this forever, I've never learned anything from success, and I have had a lot of failures. Not from lack of trying, but, you know, things go wrong, and you didn't handle that actor well, or you didn't handle that weird thing that happened on set well, and right now I go, okay, that's what happened, what would you do differently next time? But are you talking about, you know, an actor who, quote-unquote, is giving you nothing, right, or who is super predictable? Now, the great acting teacher, Sanford Meisner, who I really think is probably the greatest, especially for on-camera acting, his sort of philosophy. But, you know, he's the one who coined living truthfully under imaginary circumstances or said it often. But he also said there's no such thing as nothing. And he said you don't do anything until something happens to you and you put all your attention on the other person. So, but now if someone's not doing something, now if it's a scene where I need to get something from that person and they're stiff, that's a lot. That they're giving me a lot, because it gives you, because the other thing that makes acting fun is you want something. Now, I don't write down my actions or my wants. People often do that. That's a acting thing, right? Your intention, right? Or your action, or what you want. But you sort of, when you get to a certain point, you sort of instinctively know what the character's trying to get from somebody. So that person, then they're just the obstacle, because you need an obstacle. If you get what you want, that's sort of most network TV, where someone asks for something and it happens. But in real life, you know, what makes the play fun is the tension, is an obstacle to you getting what you want. And so it's great. If someone, I mean, it can be great. It can be awful. I mean, I think the hardest thing, but that's your challenge, right? That's your challenge as an actor, is to make it fresh and to make it real. So if I know at a certain point I'm working with somebody, and this happens very rarely these days, but if you're working with someone where you just know what they're going to do, and they're going to do it the same every time, and they're going to shout on that one line, so then you just have to find different ways to distract yourself and make it interesting. Now, and sometimes you can be perverse about it. Yeah, sometimes I will. I'll just fuck with that person, right? Because that's interesting, and you want to see if you can throw them off, not in a deleterious way, because at the end of the day, my goal is to make it, I'm there to serve the piece. I'm not there to serve Reed Diamond, the actor. I'm there to make the piece better. And I always feel my aesthetic is like, the realer it is, the more alive it is, the more unpredictable it is, that's going to be more interesting for the audience, it's going to be more interesting for the editors, and that tends to be the truth. But you know, sometimes there's nothing you can do. And the worst one, because we were just talking about that Better Call Saul scene, and I talk about, you know, it hadn't really happened in a certain level because I hadn't done my close-up, and I'm going, will I have the energy 14 hours into this shoot to actually do the scene together? I did the scene. Are you familiar with the scene I did in Moneyball with Brad Pitt?
No.
So there's a scene, a lot of people like it, in this great movie, Moneyball. And we shot it on the first day of shooting, and he and I improvised most of that scene. And the director would be underneath the camera, and just, we were shooting on film, and we'd roll out the mags. And for the first half of the day, from when we showed up until lunch, we shot Brad's coverage. And we come up with all these crazy improvs. And I remember the background players coming to me at lunch and like, oh man, you're crushing it. And I'm like, well, kind of I'm not, because it hasn't happened yet. Like, I still have to do my side. And I don't know. I've just been improvising for 6 hours. I don't think I can do it for another 6 hours. And luckily we did it in two, and it all worked out. But there's something about that pressure. But with talking about stiff actors or actors who plan stuff, there's also this, that's fine. You know, if you're going to, you got to be open to everyone's way of working. The only thing that is my pet peeve and that I hate as an actor is when you've got an actor who saves their performance for their close-up. So you've been working with them, you've been, you know, just trying to keep it real and keep it alive, and then they usually, they have there's usually two tricks they do. They either don't know their lines, so they have the producers, the directors, like, we have to shoot them last because they're learning it while you're doing it, and then they trick you, or they just have enough pull to go second for the close-ups, and then they give you, because I argue that I'm an even better actor off camera. Like, I will give you 100% every take, no matter what, because I just, that's what we're here for. That's my job. And but then when they change their performance on their close-up and you've already shot your side and you realize it's an old school trick to win the scene and to, you know, because to screw the other actor, because I'm a all boats rise together kind of guy. Like, I want us all to make the best scene together, and I want you to be better. The better you are, the better I am, because and that's also my improv background, right? That's what I love about comedy improv, is that it's an assist is better than a goal. The guy who put the ball right, you know, set you up so you can knock it into the net, that's a harder job, and that's the guy who you go with. And so, but I've worked with some bad actors, literally, you know, quote unquote, not in like the quality of their thespianism, but bad actors in the general sense. But those are the fun stories. You know, talk about what you remember, what you don't remember. I love the dirty tricksters, because I've learned a lot, and those are always the best stories to tell.
Now, you said in this a little earlier, you said, you know, there's times you've had a bad day on set. Okay. Now, how do you overcome that? Like, I remember years ago, I was performing. I was doing stand up at Garvin's in Alexandria, Virginia. Okay. Roger Mercek was a headliner. The MC was a 16-year-old kid named Dave Chappelle. Okay, so he goes on, and it's Friday. I'm like, I'm the second act, no big deal. Dave destroys. Right. I go up and I eat shit. Okay, right. I leave with my tail between my legs. Dave and his stepbrother are like, you want to come out? I'm like, no, I just went back to my hotel and sulked. And then I sat there, and the next day I got my confidence up that I can get him. So I get Saturday early show. Dave does what he does. Kills, even at that age. I go up and I slay him. I have a great set. So then I get that ego back. I got the swagger back. Late show, which is usually the easy show, because if you're the second, he goes and slays, and I eat shit more than I did on Friday night. And I just got my car, and I was living in North Jersey at the time, and I drove home, and I was like, oh, you're shattered. But I knew I didn't have a show until, like, you know, a few days later. For you, what do you do if you go on the set and you feel, because I know it's like anything, if you're a performer, you know when you're off. I know for interviews, if I'm a little bit off, I go, I'm a little bit off. I don't know what happened. How do you get back to rhythm? Because acting, there isn't like, hey, okay, Reed, you have a few days off. No, it's like, come back. Or even if you screw up a scene that you're really into, you have to rebound. How do you do that?
You know, it's taken a lifetime in this, and I'm still working on it, because there's going to be something that throws me off that I haven't encountered yet. That I'm going to have to be cognizant of in the future. But, like I say, I literally have made a checklist. So the first thing that I did on my checklist is, as you just said so well, like, you know when you're off, but sometimes you don't, because, you know, part of the show must go on mentality of an actor is like, I'm just going to muscle through it, and I'm just going to pretend this isn't happening. Now, you wouldn't do that in your work, right? In your work, if you're really living moment to moment as an actor, you have to take everything that happens, you have to experience it and not gloss over it. And the biggest lesson for me as a person, as a human, is that I have to do that, you know, between action and cut, you know, to live in the moment. But I also have to live in the moment between cut and action, because that's when a lot of shit goes down. And I know what my tells are now, so I know when I'm off. And then the trick is either, now if it's an interpersonal...
Wait, let me interrupt real quick.
Yeah.
What are your tells?
So for me, I mean, there's certainly a feeling in your stomach that something's off. I can feel myself speeding up, or I can feel myself getting shitty, or like the biggest tell is I want to go home. And I start thinking about, oh, I can't wait for the cocktail after this thing's done. And that's not how it should be. You should be wanting to be there. But now it's even gotten more subtle than that, because I've made this my focus, I think, probably for the last sort of 6 years solid, because I had a really bad experience on set, and I didn't stop Because the other thing is you just need to slow things down. Because I have a tendency just like, I'm going to muscle through. I'm going to make it happen. I can do anything. I'm a show kid, right? Like, and so the second I feel things are off, I now have to acknowledge that I kind of know what time it is and I need to sort of assess what's going on. So it might just be as simple as like, hey, I might be confused about this. Do you know the inner game of tennis? Are you familiar with the inner game of tennis?
No, I'm legally blind in one eye, so I sort of suck at tennis.
Okay, so there's this famous, the gentleman's name escapes me right now, but he wrote this book called The Inner Game of Tennis. But he came up with, basically, as he was working with tennis players and how they were their game was going down and not going well. And he says, he came up with this really simple equation. Performance, your performance equals potential, your natural potential, your training, minus interference. And that interference can be anything. It can be the voice in your head. It can be something that somebody said. And so what you want to do is remove as much interference as possible. Now, with my personality type, I'm always the guy like, oh, it must be my fault. But now, as I've gotten a little older, I go, hey, you know, maybe someone else is, I just need to get some clarification. I had this, I'm shooting 13 Reasons Why. I remember my first day on set, and I played this character, and I feel like I really know who this character is. I just talked to the creator. He basically said, it's my character from Homicide, grown up, and now he works at a school. And I was like, okay, got it. So we do the first take, and I was like, I think we nailed it. And the director's like, that was brilliant. You know, Australian guy. Yeah, it's brilliant. And then he's like, we got to go again. I'm like, okay. And so we do it again, and I feel good about it. And they're like, oh, that was great. I'm like, we need to go again. And now I'm going like, oh, I must suck. They must hate me. They're regretting hiring me. And we do it one more time, and I feel like I know who this guy is. And he's like, "That's good. Can we just do it one more time this way?" And I go, I'm sorry, hold on. And so I walk over to the Video Village, and there's two young producer writers there, really sweet guys. And I'm like, I am so sorry. But I feel like what I was doing was the character and what we're supposed to be doing here. And they're like, oh, yeah, it was brilliant. It was perfect. That's exactly what we wanted. That just so-and-so, someone in the office said they wanted a couple of different versions of it. And I was like, oh, well, that would have been really helpful information, you know. But I got the clarification, so there was no more interference. I was like, oh, yes. So you just decided you wanted different versions of it. Instead of saying it to me, you just kept saying, do it again. And so I was like, and so instead of me interfering myself and saying, oh, you're the worst actor on the planet, you suck, get some clarification. I was doing Bosch, and I had these lines, and they seemed very strange to me. They seemed to me that they could only be joke lines. So I was saying them very jokey. And they come back, no, can you just, this line, can you really just deliver it to her straight? And I'm like, okay. And it just did my instinct, like, no. And I go, I just kept doing jokey. And then they go, someone came, oh, I'm sorry. And I go, what's going on? And they go, oh, I'm sorry. And I knew the directors really well from other shows. And they go, sorry, you don't understand that we do a sort of 40s lingo on this show and we say it seriously. And it's like a patois of the show. And I go, oh, that would have been helpful information. I just assumed that he was making a joke because he's speaking like Sam Spade or whatever like that. So those little things. But that's what makes this job so exciting. You know, my overarching theme is what I love about this gig and why I don't need to play crosswords or do crosswords to, you know, offset senility is every day, every scene is a brand new challenge. And no matter what success you've had, you still have to live truthfully in the moment and create that scene. And so that's what makes it exciting. You've never done it before. Now you have your experience and you've learned lessons, but you often are going to be presented with something that you have to problem solve. You use so many different parts of your brain. It can be very exhausting. Like first days, I call it 1,000 first days of school. You know, there's so often that you have to plop in. You talked about intimacy and friendship. We were talking about that earlier on. And yes, you just plop into this show and you have to act like you've been there forever. And you are dealing with, you're meeting new people and you're oftentimes, I'm creating my character in front of strangers for the first time, right? Because it hasn't happened until you say it. You can practice as much as you want in your room, but until you're on the set in the clothes with the other actors, it hasn't really happened. And you might have to feel it out for a while. I mean, there's so many times where you start something, I go, that's not the guy, right? And it doesn't feel right. Can I just, let's try this. And then you sort of ease in. I remember when I did Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and I'm playing the bad guy season 2, and I'm there on the first, early days of shooting. Everyone's there. Like, everyone from the network, the producers, the Marvel people are there. And it's a big thing. And it's my first time being the character. And I just, at one point I was walking to Video Village. I go, it's really fun. You're finding your character in front of 1,000 people. You know, it's just, because it's challenging. And you have to have a certain level of courage that and confidence that you will find your way and it will work out. And that's the only thing that really has come from time and really being diligent about it, is that I know I'll get there, right? Because I don't know what I'm going to do, and you haven't done it until it happens, right? Each scene is new, but you know you'll get there eventually. And then some days you don't, and that's the lesson, because you needed to learn it. But sorry, you want to say something?
No, I wanted to say, you mentioned challenge, okay? Looking back, and as we said in the outset, you've been working for 40 years. And you've been, not like someone who's just like, oh, you know, you've been constantly working, you know, you're not.
Yeah.
In your career, what would you say was a role or a scene that was your biggest challenge? Because you always have to remember that, I'm sure. It's not like if you're a band and you play a shitty gig at some place, well, then you just move on. But as you said earlier, also, this shit is around forever. You know, especially now with the internet, people can find anything.
Exactly.
You know, I think you posted some of your old commercials, and you're like, oh, okay, you know. But now it's around forever. You know, everyone remember Matthew LeBlanc getting the ketchup off or the mustard off the thing. It's around forever. So, what was a scene or a role to you in your career that, looking back, you say this was the biggest challenge I've had?
Well, I'll start by saying I kind of break down. Back to what you said too about the, you know, it living forever, and that's the thing I always have to remember. I go, if I've been there for 14 hours and we're not doing my close up till 7 o'clock in the morning, it doesn't matter, because it doesn't exist until I do it, and no one at home watching will know my sob story. Because you have two choices: you can either break down and go quit, like, this isn't fair. I've been here for 14 hours. I'm tired. Right? It doesn't matter. You got to do it. I was on 13 Reasons Why, and I'm always prepared before I show up, and I had this scene where I had to give a speech to about a whole group of people, like a 3-page speech, and to a whole bunch of the cast. And so I knew when they gave that to me, I go, that's something I got to get in front of. So I spent like 3 days just making sure I knew it backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. And I get to my trailer on the day that we're going to shoot it, and it's about an hour before we're going to do the scene. And I never look at the mini sides. The mini sides are the sort of the tiny pieces of the script that you're going to shoot that day, because I feel like if I don't know it by the time I get to work, what's the point? Like, I don't bring mini sides to set. I know what I'm going to do that day, and I'm prepared. But just, I don't know what possessed me, but I picked up the mini sides for the scene we were going to do today. And I go, oh, they've completely rewritten this scene. It's completely rewritten. And I get out of my trailer, and I go to the AD's office, their trailer, and I said, hey, when did these rewrites come out? They go, oh, yeah, these came out last night. We should have sent them to you. I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah, you should have. And I go into my trailer, and I have a little conversation with myself. I go, okay, you're about to do this scene in 45 minutes with the entire cast staring at you and 50 other background players. You got two choices right now. You can figure this out, and you can learn it. Or you can just give up, and giving up's not an option. So I guess you're going to learn it. And I learned it, and I figured it out, and did it. And that's kind of the fun of what we do. But back to your question, I sort of break up the jobs I do into two categories. There's the one where I go, I hope I can make it good. And then there's the other, the one that you dream of, I hope I'm good enough. And the hope I good enough, where you know, like, if you're doing Shakespeare, or you're doing Tom Fontana, or you're doing Better Call Saul, it's like, they're not the problem. You have to rise to that occasion. But I think, you know, what is seen, I've done, there's so many. And like I say, when I said that you don't, whatever you think it's going to be like on the day, it's not. The days that have been the worst, I didn't see it coming. I thought I had it in the bag, and then something threw me off, and I never got back on track. Or you're going through something, because I think you're a human being, and you're going through something personal, and you're just in a weird place in your life, and then everything goes wrong. Everyone's saying no to you on set. But Let me see if like if I can think of, because every it's always been very exciting for me, the challenge part of it. Oh, that's such a good question. What was the most challenging? I might come up as we go. I'm trying to think, because I mean, like I say, I can remember every day that I shit the bed, and those are just the worst, right?
What was
and,
your biggest shit the bed moment?
Okay, so I've had so many, but I'll give you a funny one, because this is a bone of contention between me and my father. So it's 1991. I'm doing The Homecoming by Harold Pinter on Broadway, right? And this is my first Broadway play. I've just graduated Juilliard that spring before. I've shot season two of Law and Order, which is the only season two of the original Law and Order, which is at the time the only TV show that is shooting in all of New York City. So my plan is at the end of the run of this play, which is going to end around Christmas time in 91, I'm going to move in January to Los Angeles. Now, working on Broadway as I was as a young actor, I think you're getting $600 a week, and I certainly hadn't made a ton of money from my move to Los Angeles. And All My Children calls up, and they're going, "Hey, we'd like to offer you 3 days on All My Children to play Jeannie Francis's younger brother." And they're basically going to pay me as much as I'd made the entire run of the play. And I was like, "That's great. I can use this money to go to Los Angeles." And I was also very excited because I'd grown up watching All My Children and General Hospital, just because it had been part of my 12-year-old strategy. I was like, all the girls like the soap operas. I'm going to watch the soap opera so I can talk to the girls about soap operas. So I knew all these characters in and out. And it was amazing because it was one of those where the entire cast of that show and like One Life to Live or Loving were all there, Loving and All My Children, because it was a wedding. So all the people I could talk to them. But anyway, but soap operas, I had 25 pages of scenes, and basically the writing on those shows is you're saying the same thing just differently over and over again. It's so repetitive. So you can literally hand me 10 lines of Shakespeare and I guarantee you I can learn it in less than 15 minutes, right? Because it's just every line is the line that's supposed to go after that line, and it makes total sense. But like the soap opera stuff was 25 pages of gobbledygook. It was just saying the same banal thing over and over again, and I had so much trouble putting it into my head, right? And then the way they work is so different, because I'd already done a movie and I'd done stuff, but the way they work is you go down to your cubicle and then they call you on the loudspeaker and they put a ton of makeup on you. And I was just struggling, right? I was just struggling to make it work and say the scenes. I did at that point say, I will never, that was it. That was it for me in soap operas. I was like, I'm not cut out for this. Like, I need this, I can't, like it had a feeling of like being at school, and it was corporate. Like everyone just had their little rooms, their little offices down there, but I stunk. And it was funny, like my father, we were having dinner at Joe Allen's, and he's like, yeah, you kind of walked through that part. And he was being hypercritical. And I said, Dad, I didn't walk through it. I haven't walked through anything. I sucked. I was terrible. Like I just couldn't get in front of it. And I didn't have sort of the wherewithal now that I would, where I just would have probably just improvised a little bit. But I was just struggling to be in that world and say those words. So that was an ancient pooping the bed. But there's been, I can recount all of them. There's so many, but they're great because that thing spurred me on. Like I had, like I say, my new sort of renaissance and my love of acting is, I had a really bad day on a show 6 years ago, I guess now. And I just went home and I go, okay, you just need to sort of start over again and sort of remember what got you into this and how you approach things. And it's been great, because I think I'm more in love with acting. I'm as in love with acting as I was when I first started at 15, 16. Like, I love it. And it was so great to come back, you know, because last year with the strike, that was the longest I'd gone without working since 1985. I'd never been out of work that long. And, oh, man, when they called me to do Law & Order Organized Crime at the beginning of this year, I did a couple episodes of that, I was just... I was like a kid, you know, Christmas Eve. Like I could not wait to get there, and I was so excited to be on set every day. And And it was great because I was working, I knew Maloney from way back, and both the directors were friends of mine. So it was like, it was a really great experience. It was so great to be back, you know, playing in the candy store.
Well, you know what's funny about that show is, first of all, my wife Joanne, she never listens to my podcast. She never listens to it. So she doesn't hear it.
Right.
But she knows all my guests because this person's on. So whenever a guest of mine is on, it doesn't make a difference what show. Like, I didn't watch the first Bosch, but I watched Bosch Legacy. But the first Bosch, she'd be like, oh, Reed's on the show. Or, oh, Spencer Garrett's on the show. And I'll hear from the other room.
Right.
And it's funny because organized crime, I was at a networking event. And I had a beer, a few beers, and I had a little buzz coming home. And I was like, I'm going to have a glass of whiskey. So I sit down to put, I got this really good whiskey for my birthday. It's called Smokehouse. And I put it on the rocks, and I sit down, and we see you. And I was like, oh, cool. And it was like one of those things, because we like that show. We think Organized Crime is a really good show.
Yeah.
And the thing is, because you weren't posting about it on Facebook, so we don't know what's going to happen. And I'm going to be a spoiler, because if you're not watching a tough shit, then you end up dying. Okay. Now, when they called you back, you said they called you. You didn't audition. It was a call.
No, they offered it. Yeah.
Did they say, okay, Reed, here's the gig. You're coming in for, I think you did three episodes or two. You did, you know,
two.
Now, did they tell you it's only two episodes, or how did that work?
They did. They let me know. I mean, you always hope that it's going to go longer, but that's I think we probably talked about this before, but now that I've entered this period of my career where I play mostly bad guys, they're the best parts, right? They're so much fun, but you know you're going to die. I always die. And so I knew. So two was good. They made it very, very well worth my while. And he was such a cool character on paper, and the scenes were really fun. And they let me play, which was kind of truly amazing, which wasn't my experience on other network shows, but I improvised a lot, and they kept it in, which was awesome, which never happened. And Maloney and I, he and I did that show Underground together, and I really love acting with him, and he's super cool. And to work with Jennifer Ely and to work with Keith Carradine, and freaking Keith Carradine. I mean, I was just like, when I got that second script and I saw there's going to be a patriarch, I go, oh, who are they going to get? It's going to be somebody I love, and then it's Keith Carradine. And it was so funny because I go, oh my God. I'm such a huge fan of yours because I'm a huge fan of yours. I'm like, you're not, but it's okay. It's very nice of you to say that. And because I told him I've owned The Duelists, his movie he did, Ridley Scott's first feature. I've owned it on every format it's ever come out, and I just love him. And he's such a great actor, and he's such a nice guy. And we're sitting there in the van. You know, this is the theme of the show. We're just like, we're lucky that we get to, like, he's like, we get to play a kid's game. I'm like, I know. We're just like, you know, we never have to grow up. And it's just, it's super fun because it is amazing what we do. And it's why it's always important to, you know, never get too po-faced about it or too serious. I mean, we're really blessed. It's, you know, it's interesting because now that my wife is back at it full time and just kicking ass, she's on so much. She's got series and big movies out. And it's great to talk shop with her. And yeah, the life of an actor is, there's a lot of uncertainty, right? And certainly, you know, not working for a year, but even when there's not a strike, I very rarely know what's coming next. And then sometimes you do, but it's also what we get to do. You get to play pretend for a living and dress up. You know, it's a pretty cool gig.
Now when you were died in that show.
Yeah.
Was that you? Did they, because they don't show you getting killed. You're just, or maybe they shot it and take it, but you're just laying, like, is that you or is that a stunt double?
That is 100% me. And it's funny because the director of that was Jean de Sagonzac, who's my buddy from Homicide. So he was the DP from Homicide, and then he became a director on Homicide. And he, luckily, because of Homicide, because they used to leave dead people on the ground, like, you know, local background people on the ground. I mean, I've seen African Americans, we've turned blue, right? Because it's so cold on the street. And so we developed a certain point. I remember Jean was like the first guy. I was like, we got to get this guy off the ground. Back when we were shooting in Baltimore, like, these people, because you forget when someone's playing a dead body that they're actually a real person. And I've shot movies where they forget that these dead bodies. I did a thing of The Terror, and we had a bunch of Japanese. We were on the, you know, one of the Pacific Islands, and there was a bunch of guys in a pond, like, or there's even some sort of, like, swamp, dead, and it's Vancouver, and it's 30 degrees Fahrenheit, and these guys are, like, they're turning blue too. We're like, I was like, get these guys out of here. And but anyway, but it was funny on this one. He had respect for me, but it's so funny when you play a dead body because everyone else treats you like a dead body. So I got into this weird position, and I got into a position that was really comfortable. And then Maloney comes on, he's like, hey, Reed, the way you're laying, you look like the cutout of a dead guy. you have to, and so he's directing me from below. He's like, move your arm here and make it more awkward. So then it got really painful. And then I'm just like, the blood's going into my face. And of course, because it's TV and nothing's like you think it's going to be, I still had scenes to shoot afterwards where I had to look really good. So I'm like, oh, I don't want to get the blood in my hair. Now they're going to have to take the blood out of my hair. It's going to take forever. But it was painful. But then you're going like, wow, I get to play a dead body. It's not that bad. And Jean's like, hey, let's move it along quickly. Only a few people stepped on me. And luckily no one dropped a camera on my head. But yeah, I die a lot. But I worked on, when I did Bosch, they had this scene where I had to be dead in the scene for, but I did an autopsy scene, but I also did one where I was dead on the floor. And I've been doing this Wim Hof breathing. Do you know who Wim Hof is?
No.
He's a crazy Danish guy, but he's got this breathing method, and he's what is he? He's the ice god, or what the heck is he? He can be submerged in freezing water and not feel it. And he controls his own heart rate. He's amazing. But part of the thing is holding your breath for longer and longer periods of time. So I do it every morning, and I'm up to, you know, I've got up to about 3 minutes. So I'm just laying there, and you know, that's part of the challenge. Like, oh wow, I can hold my breath for 3 minutes, because that's always the hard thing. Like, usually when you're playing a dead body, you're trying to anticipate when the camera's going to be on you, and then you sort of breathe out right before and just try to hold still. But on this one, I was like, I didn't know when the camera was going to be on me, so I held my breath for 3 minutes. So that you know what, Steve, that was my most challenging scene.
Holding your breath. Now, talking about dying, what is your favorite scene where we actually saw you get killed? Has there been a scene that you sat there and went, like, because, you know, sometimes I always think it must suck if you're the actor when they had like 20 squibs on you, and all of a sudden you, and then like you start laughing and they go, what the hell?
Those are the best. No, the thing is, like, the thing as a guy, as a professional deceased person on television, who's had many creative deaths, I've been blown up in a nuclear explosion in a subway. I've been tied to a rock like a Greek mythological character and eaten by birds. But I think the what you want is a good death. You don't want a bad death. You don't want and especially if you've been playing a really bad guy, I want a really awesome death. I've been hung. I've been shot numerous times. The hardest part when you get shot is the first time I got shot. No, not the first time. One of the first times. I got shot by Antonio Banderas in this movie with him and Stallone, Assassins, or I think it was called, right? I can't remember. And but I had to trigger my own. So I had a little device with two buttons on it where in my pocket. So I had to, as Antonio shot me, I had to then trigger my own. But now you don't have to do that kind of stuff. But you just want a good one. I at one point I made a tombstone with all of my characters on it and just ran off the tombstone onto the ground. But I did. I had a conversation with my agent, my manager the other day. I was like, look, we gotta find me some good guys because I want to stay on a show a little bit longer. Like I said, the bad guys are the most fun. But they just don't stick around. And then I played a good guy. That's the guy who got blown up by the nuclear weapon. But then they were like, oh, we really like him. So now the audience will be really upset if you die. I'm like, oh. But the bad death you don't want. I had the worst one on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. where Clark just shot me in the back. And I've been playing like a supervillain. I'm like, really? Really? So you can just get rid of him by shooting him? Like, someone could have done that a long time ago. That was the lamest. So now it's funny after that. But that was one of those lessons where I go, they called me up, and they're so nice, because my friends Marissa and Jed were the showrunner, executive producers on that. Like, hey, Reed, we're so sorry, but, you know, your character's going to die in the next episode. It's like, great, 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 I assumed. But then the death wasn't good, and I was like, oh, now on, if the death's not good, I'll refuse to die. I'm like, you're going to have to come up with a better demise for me, because, you know, I want to go out with a bang.
Have you ever gotten written off the show, either died or written off, that you weren't expecting? And then how do you deal with that as an actor? Because, you know, it's like, as you said before, you think everything's going good and it's ups and downs. And I repeat mm-hmm. this all the time. The thing about performers, and, you know, and I'm one of them, then we're half narcissistic and we're half insecure. I think because that's, we want to be seen, but then we're like, oh, we got this gig, but are we going to be good enough? So was there any job you had where you just got the carpet pulled right out from you, like you either you got written off or it just ended and you were like, holy shit, like I was already expecting my residual money when it goes into syndication?
Yeah, well, definitely, the one lesson I will tell you is don't spend that money until, until you've received it, right? Because you can have the highest hopes and hope, right? You know, that's the true myth of Pandora's box, right? You know, they released all of the emotions and things into the world, and the only thing that was left was hope. And that was supposed to seem like a positive thing, but no, hope is the most dangerous of all. That's why it had to be kept in the box, because hope leads to nothing. So I'll tell you a funny twist on that. I was on a show that I didn't think I was going to die on, but I was really hating being on that show. Now, the only people who've ever called me in my career when I died were Marissa and Jed, and that's one of the reasons I love them madly and would do anything for them. They had the courtesy to call, but sometimes people like to surprise you. But I was on this show, which I won't say for obvious reasons now, but I hated it. I wanted off this show so fucking bad. And when the script came, where I was killed, I just did a dance of joy around my room. I was like, oh, thank God I'm dead. So I don't have to request to be killed. And I was on another show where they didn't tell me. And on that show, I didn't like my death either. But from a structural point of view, from a script point of view, I didn't think it worked. And I worked with an actor recently who was on a Joss Whedon show, actually, and they killed his character, and he refused to come to work. He got the script where his character died, and he refused to come. He didn't want to get killed. And so he contacted his agent, and he did sort of like some sort of filibuster and didn't show up, and they changed it, and they kept his character alive. And I was like, oh. So that's on my list of things to do. I was like, oh, I'm going to file that away. So if ever, because on this one show where they killed me, where I was happy to be off the show because it was sort of a toxic environment, but I was like, this isn't the right end for my character, and you shouldn't kill him, you should kill somebody else, because dramaturgically, as one might say, went to Juilliard. But I realized, oh, I could have just been like, oh, I'm not coming until you fix it. So I didn't realize you had that power.
Now you know. So you learn something all the time. Now tell me about Orphan Black. Now, is your wife in that too?
She is, because she has to be in all the jobs.
Well, first of all, real quick, how is it working with her? I mean, I know it's great, but it's like you see each other all the time. Well, I guess you're actors, so you don't. It's not like people I know who have an office and they work with their wives and then they go home. It's not like, because if you don't know acting, it may look like it's all in one day, but Reed could be doing a scene at 2 a.m. till 8 a.m. and his wife could be working from 10 a.m. to whatever, and then she's doing her thing and then he's sleeping. So tell me about the show and then what it's like working with her.
Well, what's cool is, so my wife and I met on a movie 22 years ago. We did a Lifetime movie of the week called Scared Silent with Penelope Ann Miller and me, and my wife and I met, and we hadn't worked on anything together since then. She's had an illustrious career. She retired for 12 years and then came back bigger than ever. She's had a Dream Scenario right now with Nick Cage. She's on, they finished the second season of The Way Home, the show she does with Andy McDowell. She's in tons of great movies. She just finished M. Night Shyamalan movie. She's crushing it, but so while she was doing all that, I got on Orphan Black. And Orphan Black is just a dream come true. Orphan Black Echoes, which is coming out in June, which I'm super excited about. And so I got offered that in the summer of 2022. And the showrunner, Anna Fischko, creator, just loved her. She grew up a couple of blocks from me. I used to have band practice in her building. So we reminisced about the neighborhood. So there was a character I remember reading in the subsequent script. I'm like, oh my God, Marnie, my wife, Marnie McPhail Diamond, she would be brilliant for this part. And then cut to, she has an audition for it, and then she's kicks ass. And then Anna calls me and she's like, I want Marnie to be on this show. And we got to make it happen because Marnie was literally on 5 other shows that week and they had to sort of schedule it so she could be there for her first day of shooting. And I said, I'm her manager. We're going to make this work. And we did all make it work. But she and I can't really talk about script, but we didn't have any scenes together, but we did get to hang out on set together, which was amazing. But we do act together all the time because one of the greatest parts, I'm very lucky. Yeah, I think probably as your audience knows, and you know for sure, that we're now in the world of self-taping. There's no more going into a room to audition really anymore. That's done, right? And COVID really put that was the final nail in that one, but which I love because it's afforded me the opportunity to live places that aren't Los Angeles or New York or Toronto or Vancouver if I don't want to be there. And it's given people a lot more freedom. But I live with the best actor I've ever met, and so we get to do each other's self-tapes together. So I'm her off camera, she's my off camera, and it's like going to work. So I'm working with the best actor I could possibly do. We do the scenes like we're on a show. We play, And she certainly helped me get a lot of jobs. And I've been some small part in helping her. But it's kind of, we get to act together, you know, depending on how often things are coming in, a lot. So I'm hoping we get to work together on film soon, but it would be perfect. But going on doing self-tapes together, she's the best acting partner, but also the most withering critic, right? There's no, you know, you can't pull any BS with each other. She's like, nah, well, I know you can do better. That was pretty bad. And
now, what makes you so excited about Orphan Black, though? Yeah, I know you can't talk about the scripts, but you said, I'm so excited about this. Is it that good? Is it the set? Is it the story? Is it what makes it? Like, I'm sure, and you mentioned earlier, you know, you were on a job. It was a toxic environment. And sometimes you walk in, especially after a strike, you may have a role 100%. That you know this is going to suck, but hey, I got bills. You know, and I'm an actor. And unfortunately, if I can show up to a shitty project and give my best, I've done my job. I didn't write it. I didn't direct it.
Right.
I'm going to bring what I have to the table, and I'm going to say, my job's, it's done. But what makes you seem, your eyes lit up when you talked about it? Why were you so excited about this show?
Well, you know, because you're so right. Because so many things have to come together perfectly for a show to be successful. And you have to. So first of all, number one, it has to be on the page. You know, if it's not on the page, it's not on the stage. So they sent me the script, and Anna had written an incredible script. I just love the way she writes. And she had written me an incredible character, just like a character where I immediately go, oh, I want to play that guy. So that was number one. And then you have to get there and see who you're playing with, right? Because you can assemble a bunch of jerks. But they put together an amazing cast, working with Keeley Hawes and Kristen Ritter and a bunch of just wonderful actors that I got to play with. So that's great. So you got incredible scene partners, and then the scripts just kept getting better. And then Anna and I and the other writers, we all had a really good relationship. So as soon as, you know, when a series is a living, breathing thing. So they have an idea, and then I do something, and they go, oh, well, now we saw what Reed did. Now the character shifts, and they write scenes to you, and she's so, this character started as one thing and then expanded and grew into this whole other thing. And that's the same. And all the shows that I've enjoyed being on, it is that marriage. It's that symbiosis of working together and them informing you and you informing them. That's what happened on Homicide. When I showed up on Homicide, they had a very distinct idea of who they thought that character should be. And I, unbeknownst to them, had been preparing to play a cop for 3 years and obsessed with it. And I had a different idea of who that character should be. And we sort of met somewhere, and he took on a journey that none of us could have expected. I mean, that's the metaphor of how we started. Like, 1 + 1 = infinity. So I bring something to the table, they bring something to the table, and if we're able to play with each other and open to each other, that it becomes 1 + 1 = infinity, infinitely more than any of us could have imagined. And I think those are the best shows to work on, is people who know that trust each other people's creative instincts and create a space for them to, whether you're the sound mixer or whether you're the DP, where you go, I know I've hired that person, they know what they're doing, and then we all sort of collaborate together and make something bigger than any of us could have imagined. That's the goal. It doesn't always happen. But that show's great because I love the people I work with. I love the creators. I love the directors. John Fawcett, who created the original Orphan Black, he's there. Really fun people to play with. And then they wrote me, I would say, probably in my top two favorite characters of all time. That's just a really, it's as if Mike Kellerman from Homicide and Lawrence Dominic from Dollhouse is as if they got together and made one person. And it's a really incredible creative environment. So that's why I'm excited for people to see it. And I think, like, and that's just me personally, I just think the scripts are really interesting, and I love the story. And you don't have to have seen the original Orphan Black to just dive right in. It's a really smart vision of what the future could be, the near future could be.
That's so important that you said you don't have to see the original, because there's shows I want to see. Like, as I said, when we mentioned Bosch, I had saw the first season of Bosch, but I just was busy. I'm going to watch Bosch Legacy. Right. I could just jump right into it. You know, Joanne, she had not seen Breaking Bad, but then she started watching Better Call Saul, then she went back and binged Breaking Bad and that's so important now, because it does, because we can stream, but I don't want to sit there and go, oh, wait, I got to watch four seasons. If someone
you
says
you need to do homework,
that's yeah, like Fargo. Fargo's so good because the show Fargo, every season's different. So
right.
You go, you know, okay, so it's good. So now your career, you've had a very successful career. Who was someone you worked with that you just went, holy shit, I'm working with this person? Like, I interviewed Terry Serpico last week, and he said, like, one of his first scenes.
Terry, yeah.
Well, one of his first scenes, it was with Johnny Depp and Al Pacino and Donnie Brasco. So you're like, holy God, that's overwhelming. Have you ever been, first one, have you ever been overwhelmed because you met someone, you're like, oh my God? And two, who have you sat there and went, oh my God? Like, the two, I'm giving you the two, as an actor, I went to two lengths of, oh my God, like, oh my God, and then, oh my God.
I've definitely been overwhelmed many times. And it's interesting, when I was a younger actor, we talk about sort of the trajectory of growing up and learning more about yourself and how you occur. When I first started, I was very, I'm an extrovert, but I would be very shy and very deferential, and I didn't really sort of give full vent to my personality. And so I would sometimes work with people who I really admired, but I'd sort of keep everything under the close to the vest. And I wouldn't be very expressive. And it's interesting. There was a certain point in my career where I was doing a lot of guest stars. And I realized, oh my God, I'm showing up like a guest. And I can't do my work if I'm a guest. You know, a guest has to be polite and has to just like not break the rules and don't sit on the wrong sofa, right? And I was like, fuck that. I can't do that. That's not acting. Acting isn't polite. And that's not really who I am. I can't really create that instant intimacy. And sometime in the late 90s, early 2000s, like, I'm not going to show up as a guest anymore. So then when I met my heroes, I could be very effusive. So if I'm working with somebody I love now, like I just said with Keith Carradine, we haven't even met for 30 seconds. I'm like, I just love you so much. You're so talented. And then we can really, and that's great. And who doesn't want to hear that? But when I first started out, like, I remember, well, I'll tell you two very funny stories from the beginning. So my first movie is Memphis Belle. Right. So it's a tale of a bomber crew in the Second World War. And the cast are all of my heroes. I'm working with Eric Stoltz and Matthew Modine and D.B. Sweeney and, you know, these people who I just adore. And they're like my young sort of acting heroes. And when we first showed, they sent us all over to London. We all meet. And for the first week, I didn't even speak. So intimidated and so quiet. And their joke about me is, for the first week I didn't speak, and then for the next 3 months I never shut up. Because once I was like myself, I was like just cracking jokes and improvising and just being goofy all the time, because that's my normal personality. But I, you know, it took me a while to warm up, and that was still sort of my mode. Because then the year later I did a movie with Jessica Lange, and she was very removed, very reserved when I worked with her. We did this Willa Cather Hallmark Hall of Fame, back when they used to do those sort of like prestige pictures, Hallmark Hall of Fame for CBS. And we're doing this Willa Cather thing, and we were brother and sister. And I was just so intimidated that I sort of went inside myself. And I always regretted it. I always felt bad. And then that story came full circle, because then I came and did Feud. And she's playing Joan Crawford, and I'm playing her boyfriend. And then we were able to, like, I was able to heal all of that. That's the best part, too, about coming back and having a long career, is sometimes you think, oh, everyone hated me, or I was a schmuck, I ruined it, I blew it. And then you get a chance to say, oh, that wasn't true, or you get to fix it. And then she and I had a ton of fun on Feud, and because I was now myself. And I think that's, you know, we talked about, you know, interference or obstacles. I mean, the biggest obstacle, I think, to any actor is just you. That's the thing that gets in the way, is your insecurities or your fears, and you just have to be bold. I mean, now when I go on set, I just immediately I'm open. I'm comfortable with being myself from the get-go, and that usually works out a lot better, because you want people to feel comfortable, and everyone's nervous. That's my favorite part. I worked with one of the greatest experiences I ever had. I got to be in a scene with Charles Durning. And Charles Durning, you know who he is. I mean, incredible actor. You know, not only is he a multi-award winner, but the guy's a freaking war hero, right? Like, he landed it on D-Day at Normandy. He got machine gunned. He got bayoneted. He had his throat slit. And he just kept going back out there. Like, this man's a hero. He's brave. So he comes on Homicide, and he's doing this episode where he's like the old cop, and we do this scene, and I'm sitting right next to him, where he has to tell this story. He has this two-page monologue or whatever, being directed by Steve Buscemi, who's a doll. And Charles Durning does the first take of it, and it's just magic. And then he does a second take, and it's magic. And he does a third take, and then after he goes, that one was good. I go, so Durning, I go, they were all great. And he goes, but that was the first one where I wasn't worried if you guys thought I was any good. And I go, and I said, it never goes away, does it? And he goes, it never goes away. And it was such an important lesson. And it's interesting now that you're never not going to be nervous. Everyone has a first day, and it's hard. And it's interesting now with my wife's, you know, we're working big stars, and it's great to have that, to not be afraid to tell the truth and have those conversations. And you realize everyone's nervous, and everyone's having a first day, and it's better to talk about what's going on instead of pretend it isn't. So,
well, yeah. I've learned, you know, talking to a lot of people in business and stuff like that if something's going wrong, you know, you should never fake it till you make it. Because most people, like you're creative, I'm creative. We can see through the bullshit. Like when I go into a business room, you know, my background, I'm like full of shit. Oh, that person, you know, and that's so important that people, everyone's in the same boat. And that's the thing. And you have to sit there. And if you're thinking, like my mom always taught me, if you don't know what a word means, ask. And I've asked people, oh, what does that word mean?
So
and no one's ever said, oh, you're stupid. No, they said, oh, you don't know. And people don't get that. And I'm like, I do it all the time, you know. And I always say fake words. And my wife always corrects me. And I go, I'm joking. I know the word.
Right.
But okay, we're going to get wrapping up soon. I want to ask you.
Oh, dude, that was a perfect story, though, Steve. That's exactly right. That's it. Yeah, don't be afraid to ask the word. Your mom's smart.
Now, what are you most proud about in your career? Because, you know, I know so many actors, like you, character actors, they never feel like they're successful. I used to laugh when people would say, oh, I was on a few pilots and they didn't get picked up. I'm like, yeah, but you made a pilot. I mean, that's so much more than, that's what everyone would sit there. I mean, that person doing the YouTube short going, oh, I'm an actor. It's like, they wish they had a pilot that got canceled. Because then they tell everyone, oh, I had a pilot, but you know, it wasn't me. It got canceled for that reason because they're full of shit. But looking back, what makes you most proud, or just a few things that make you most proud about your career? Because you've worked and the only time, as you said, the only time you were off was when the strike was going on, and that you couldn't help that. But what do you think, looking back, a few things that just make you the most proud?
Well, the number one thing that I'm most proud of is that people still want to hire me, right? Because that's the thing, you know, every actor, and the longer you do it, you think, well, it's over, it was a fluke, it was a mistake, no one really liked me, and now I'm done. And every time you go a month or 2 months or 3 months or whatever without working, you're like, ah, that might be over. I might be done. They might be done with Reed Diamond types. But the thing that I'm definitely most proud of is that I still love it, and people still get that I love it, and people still want to hire me and work with me. And because I got into this for the long haul. The reason I went to Juilliard was I go, you know, I'm an actor, and I was already working as an actor. I was earning a living as an actor, but I go, I want to be classically trained because I want to play Lear when I'm 70. I want to do this forever. I never want to retire. And I get to do this. I get to do the thing I love. And yeah, there's uncertainty, but the rewards outweigh that. And I've met amazing people. Now, as far as things I've been involved with, yeah, you know, people go, when was your big break? I'm like, which one? Right? I've had a bunch, right? Because it's the thing is, and now when you can look back and you've been doing it forever and you have some confidence, because wisdom is just knowledge that you've gained through time, right? It's not, you know, because you meet smart kids all the time. I meet kids like, you know, young actors now who I'm just, there's so many great young actors out there. I'm so excited to work with them because they're just like so hungry and so cool and so open. But the only thing I have is I've got hours in. And what all the hours in tell you is that there's going to be peaks and there's going to be valleys. You know, the hardest thing for a young actor, and for me specifically, is it seems like an upward trajectory, right? You're just in a constant upward, you know, you're just heading to the stratosphere. And then you have your first, you know, punch in the face, kick in the dick, as I like to say. And you just hit that bottom, and it's about crawling out. And that's what a life is about. Like, it's, you can't predict. I didn't have goals. I mean, I knew what I kind of wanted to do, but I have a career that far exceeded what I would have imagined. And I'm very lucky, you know, just because I say yes to things. And you never know. You never know if that show, if you're going to get killed, or if that show is going to turn into a hit, or if you want to get off that show because everyone's a nightmare. You just don't even know. But I love what I do, and I'm so glad that I'm as passionate and more passionate than I've ever been. And I've done great things. But the thing that, what's so interesting about this gig And I think that's life, right? You can't rest on your laurels. It doesn't matter. It will get you through the door. It might keep you, but every day, and I think that's what's exciting about it, is every day and every scene, you kind of have to prove yourself. You have to deliver. And I don't think that's a negative. I think that's really exciting. And you're not going to get it. You're not going to, they're not all going to be home runs. But there's something noble in the attempt to be your best and bring your best self to work every single day.
Well, there you go, man. That's good stuff. I'll tell you, see, that's why you have a great actor on the show. What's coming up? Yeah, you have Orphan Black in June. You're dead on Organized Crime. Ha, I ruined it for you bastards, because you should be watching it first
you
run.
You should be watching it.
And we DVR it. So, and we got to know what else you're coming up on, because if I don't see it, I will, because Joanne will go, read Diamonds On. And she doesn't talk like that. But
please give Joanne all my love. And thank you, because she's awesome. And I'm so glad you guys are happy and living together. And
no, I hate her. No,
yeah, you love her. But no, so I've got the one thing I can talk about, the Orphan Black Echoes coming out on AMC in June. And that's going to be exciting, 10 episodes. And then I'm about to go off to faraway lands to shoot a very exciting movie that I'm very excited about, and maybe one of the greatest parts I've ever had the opportunity to play, which I can't tell you about at all. Everything is top secret these days. But so I'm in a good place where I know what the next thing is. So, you know, I've come out of the strike in a really lovely and very fortunate place. So, but Orphan Black Echoes is next, and as soon as I can talk to you about what I'm the other thing I'm doing, I'll be sure to let you know.
All right, well, people, so go check out Reed. As you said, go to IMDb. Look at all his works. You know, Homicide's hard to find. You know, but people, if you can buy it, you might be able to buy it. Or, you know, just.
You can buy it on DVDs, yeah.
Buy it on DVDs. Homicide was a great show. And so go check out Reed's work. Go to my website, coopertalk.net. You might be listening on, and if you're not, you might be listening on iTunes, you might be listening on one of the internet stations. But you can find over 1,000 episodes. And that's, I love saying that. You can find over 1,000 episodes. So go there.
So cool.
You can email me at cooper@coopertalk.net. Instagram @CooperTalk1, Twitter @CooperTalk, Facebook CooperTalk Radio. I'm Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guest. Don't forget, drink your water, eat your vegetables, take your vitamins, and I'll talk to you next time.